We're talking about Facebook and its vision for the future of the internet here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced last month that Facebook is now Meta at the company's annual conference.
We're now looking at and reporting on our business as two different segments, one for our family of apps and one for our work on future platforms.
Peel back the name change, though. The social media giant is embroiled in troubles, accused of amplifying online hate and extremism, failing to protect children from harmful content, and lacking transparency. Are you on Facebook? Are you concerned about how it does business? 800-642-1234. Shannon Bond is tech correspondent for NPR, covering Silicon Valley and how big tech transforms our lives and our work. Shannon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It seems like we hear a tale of two Facebooks. On one hand, it's the enormous market share, the billions of monthly users all over the world. And that other storyline is that it's like its grave plot will be next to MySpace, that it's losing the coveted young audience and it's your grandmother's platform. So which trajectory do you see?
I mean, I think it's frankly both, and they're kind of wrapped up in each other. And I know it can seem like a contradiction, right? Mm. Because of course, this is the world's biggest social network, right? There are almost 3 billion monthly users of just Facebook alone. When you add in other apps like Instagram, WhatsApp, and Messenger that this company also owns, it's more than 3 billion people logging in every month. And so it has this, you know, powerful hold over the way we communicate, over the way people do business, and especially outside of the US. But we've also seen, you know, these revelations from these leaked documents from a whistleblower, we've seen a lot of concerning material about the company. And frankly, we're seeing what's really striking about them is the company's own concerns, right? This is a company that does not want to be MySpace. It does not want to be left behind. It wants to make sure it is leading wherever communication goes next, whatever sort of the next stage of the internet is. It wants to be there, and that means attracting young people, attracting younger users, making sure whatever format we're communicating in next, that, you know, they're really dominating.
Why would Facebook even need to tap into the young kid market, to need to tap into the playdate market, if you will, if its platforms are growing organically?
Yeah, so that was something we saw in these documents that came out from a whistleblower, this real focus inside the company on figuring out how to reach the next generation of users and even young kids. And I think what's happening here is, look, you know, there are multiple social networks that Facebook owns, right? They own Facebook, they own Instagram, they have a messaging app called Messenger. They have a version of that for kids. And the truth is that especially in the US, usage of Facebook has slowed down, and basically the user base is getting older and older. You know, there's a joke that it's become boomer book, right? That it's that young people, especially in their 20s and teens, are frankly just not on Facebook. And so that was a big part, you know, for a long time, everyone's looked at Instagram because, you know, Instagram was the, you know, the cooler, younger sister to Facebook. But at the same time, what these documents shown is that there's also been, you know, what looks like a potential slowdown in growth of Instagram among younger users, maybe fewer people joining, younger users who are on Instagram are posting less. And that's a sort of existential threat, right? Because, you know, eventually the older users of Facebook won't be around any longer. And they need that pipeline of younger users who they hope maybe will start with an app that's directed more at kids, then maybe move into Instagram, then maybe move into Facebook. Like, that's the sort of the life cycle of the user, right? Mm-hmm. And they want to make sure that, you know, pipeline is being replenished.
That cradle to grave philosophy. Yeah. Shannon Bond with us, technology correspondent for NPR, covering Silicon Valley, covering Facebook. You can join in. What do you think is the biggest advantage of social media? And what about the downsides? What have you heard about the so-called metaverse? 800-642-1234. Before we do get to the leaked documents, I want to look at the Federal Trade Commission, a key government regulator of business conduct on the internet. It's been looking to how Facebook has swallowed up its competitors, buying its rivals Instagram and WhatsApp. How has the FTC gone after Facebook over allegedly stifling competition?
Yeah, well, it's almost a year ago now that the FTC first sued Facebook. It was back in December 2020, you know, under the Trump administration. And you know, this is a really blockbuster antitrust lawsuit. So the core accusation that the FTC made was that Facebook sort of had this strategy, which are called buy or bury. So that's how it approached competitors. So it either, you know, when up and coming rivals were, you know, looking, maybe they were going to be, you know, taking away some of Facebook's market share, attracting users that Facebook wanted for itself. The company took this approach, the FTC says, of either buying up these nascent competitors before they could become real rivals. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Instagram and WhatsApp, you know, Facebook paid billions of dollars to acquire these apps and to acquire their users. And then the other part of this is the FTC accuses Facebook of luring other up-and-coming companies with access to its platform and data, saying like, you can build, you know, you're a developer, you can build an app, you know, in Facebook, and, you know, really getting them sort of hooked in and then cutting that off. And so basically, you know, cutting them off at the knees. And so what the agency says is that's, you know, anti-competitive conduct, that that's just not a fair way to grow. And so it wants Facebook, it wants a court to, you know, order Facebook to make changes to the way it approaches acquisitions and to potentially even sell or spin off Instagram and WhatsApp. Now, Facebook, as you can imagine, says there's just no case here at all, that this is just, you know, they shouldn't be punished for being successful. Facebook argues that by buying Instagram and WhatsApp, it made them as successful as they are now. And so it's asked the court to dismiss this case. There's been a bit of back and forth where the court actually asked the FTC to come back and file a new lawsuit with kind of more clear data showing that Facebook really does have monopoly power, you know, control in the social media market. So this case is going to be dragging on for quite a while.
And Congress people have asked Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen, what would happen if you break up Facebook? What would happen if you break up big tech? What would that solve? What is the answer to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are really mixed opinions here. I think one of the things that's interesting about Frances Haugen's opinion, she's the Facebook project manager who leaked these documents. She has said she doesn't actually think antitrust or breakup is the answer here, because her real concern is about the harms of the platform. And her, as I understand it, her concern about breaking up, if you split apart, say, Facebook and Instagram, you know, if Instagram has the stronger growth, as we spoke about, and you know, is a place where maybe more advertisers want to spend money, she's concerned that risks pulling money away from Facebook and making it harder for Facebook, the platform itself, to deal with the kind of harms like hate speech and misinformation and, you know, false information about vaccines that we see flying around the platform. And, you know, so her view is that there's not, that breaking up the company doesn't actually address the core problems. But there are plenty of people who say the reason that we see all of these problems on Facebook is because they don't face real competition. Hmm. That if there was real competition in the marketplace over user privacy, over different kinds of features, people would feel like they had options. And that would force Facebook to build solutions, right? And to act more competitively. So, you know, I think there's pretty good arguments on both sides.
NPR's Shannon Bond reports on Facebook as tech correspondent. You can join in. What are your thoughts on the so-called Facebook papers that show the company prioritized engagement over stopping misinformation and hate speech? Have you considered quitting Facebook? What do you see when you go online? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Shannon Bond here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Facebook's vision for the future and its legal troubles. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testified before a Senate committee last month on the impact of Facebook on society. She brought forth findings from internal research and told Congress, look, Facebook's products harm kids.
Facebook has a product that is very attractive. The reason why they have the study of problematic use is because it is kind of addictive. And those kinds of things, like having lots of little feedback loops, keeps kids engaged.
How does your teen use social media? What do you think of Facebook, Instagram, or other apps? How do you fix Facebook? 800-642-1234. NPR's tech correspondent Shannon Bond is with us for the hour. Shannon, let's dig into the Facebook papers. So just a bit of the timeline here. September, the Wall Street Journal publishes the Facebook files, the series of reports based on these leaked documents. And this is when we learn that Facebook knew that Instagram was worsening body image issues among teenagers. And then the Facebook papers leaked to news organizations, including NPR. What are your big takeaways from these documents?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really like stunning set of documents, right? This is thousands and thousands of pages of internal research, internal reports and presentations, and long discussions on Facebook's internal version of Facebook, which is called Workplace, where Facebook employees talk about the work they're doing and talk about the platform. And, you know, this covers these papers, they cover a huge range of subjects, that how Facebook handles hate speech, you know, how its artificial intelligence algorithms struggle to look at content in other languages other than English, you know, as you said, the impact of Instagram on some teenagers' mental health, lots of studies of this question of how addictive Facebook is, all kinds of problems and concerns that this whistleblower has raised. And I think what strikes me sort of that makes this still different, right? This is a company that's been in crisis for years. I mean, I've been covering them for a while, from well before I was covering them. They have often been in these crises of their own making, but often it's sort of been about, you know, external factors, right? How Russian trolls interfered using Facebook in the 2016 election, the Cambridge Analytica data privacy scandal, which again was sort of an outside actor misusing Facebook data. What's different here is this is inside Facebook, right? This is Facebook's own researchers, Facebook's own employees, you know, identifying problems, raising concerns, saying, I think we need to change things. Are we getting the balance right when it comes to protecting our users versus pursuing, you know, unending growth? And then as the picture that's painted in these papers is often being dismissed, ignored, or downplayed by leadership, just not having a lot of traction in order to actually sort of make some of these changes that these researchers argue would make the platform a better, safer place for its own users and for society at large.
Facebook has come under scrutiny in these papers because of its negative effect on teen safety. The company stopped plans for an Instagram for kids, as you mentioned. What other impact are you seeing from these papers on how Facebook regards children and the uses of their platforms with kids?
I mean, we're just not really sure what the long-term impact is going to be. So Facebook had been working on developing a version of Instagram for younger kids. So just for people don't know, most social media apps, there's an age cutoff of 13. You have to be at least 13 to use them. That's because of federal privacy regulations. And so what Facebook was looking at doing was building a version for younger teens that would have more stringent protections, that would have parental controls. They've put that work on pause, but you know, they haven't said they're abandoning it entirely. What they have said they are going to continue to do is working on providing better parental controls for, you know, all kids under 18 on its other apps, right? Because there's plenty of people aged, you know, 13 to 18 on these apps. And so I think I think that's sort of the immediate response we see. There's going to be more parental controls offered to, you know, parents of kids who are on Instagram now. Frankly, I don't know whether the blowback on this from all these papers will really make them, you know, scrap rather than pause their broader ambitions. But as we spoke about, you know, earlier in the hour, this is an existential threat for Facebook. They do want and need younger users. And so, you know, I would be surprised to see them walking away entirely from younger kids.
Some of the things that I'm hearing from you, I think it was a report in The Guardian recently that concluded in its headline that Facebook was born, lives, and thrives in scandal. Is recklessness just part of its DNA, part of what Facebook is?
I mean, you know, this is a company whose early motto was move fast and break things, right? And it really, you know, they took pride in this sort of the Silicon Valley mantra of, you know, you just got to try things, you got to evolve, you got to iterate. You always have to be growing and moving. You kind of, you know, it's like the shark that can't stop swimming, right? In order to live. But the reality is, this is now a company with, you know, tens of thousands of employees, you know, with billions of users around the world, and it can't operate at that sort of breakneck pace. But I think, you know, what I hear from talking to former employees, certainly the message from Frances Haugen, you know, this whistleblower, is, you know, I think a lot of people will point the finger at CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Because at the end of the day, this is very much his company. I mean, it's literally his company. It's a publicly traded company, but he is the controlling shareholder. He has the majority of voting shares. And at the end of the day, you know, what he says goes. But also in the way operationally, you know, as a chief executive, he's very hands-on. He gets very involved with very specific problems. You know, and there's a sense when you're reading through many of these messages in the Facebook papers, these internal discussions, there's just over and over again, people refer back to like things that Mark has said and the way Mark sort of sees the purpose of social media, sees the role of the company. I mean, his vision is what dominates at this company. And I think now we're sort of seeing this broader reckoning with that. Like, has that created, you know, a good force in the world?
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Shannon Bond, who is a tech correspondent for NPR, covering Silicon Valley, covering how big tech companies like Facebook change our lives and affect our work. You can join in. How do you use Facebook? Have you thought about quitting Facebook? What other apps do you use? And how do you think about privacy as you use these platforms? 800-642-1234. Just want to look past our borders for a moment. Frances Haugen in Europe, I think in Paris today. How do you see Haugen's message absorbed and received by the European Parliament as it looks at regulation and privacy for Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, I think the general sense in the tech industry has been that when we're thinking about like what is sort of, you know, big change to tech policy and tech regulation coming, it is going to come in Europe before it comes in the U.S. Europe mm-hmm. is moving faster on this. You know, they've clearly indicated an interest in this. You know, there are several, you know, laws being worked on in Europe right now that would really affect the way that not just Facebook, but Google, Apple, Amazon all operate. And so, you know, I my sense is her message is being well received because this is an audience that is primed to be pretty skeptical of big tech and of big tech's power. And to say, look, there just need to be more guardrails. And that's fundamentally the message that Frances Haugen is putting out there. Saying, you know, she's not saying shut down Facebook tomorrow. She is saying, you know, that there are people inside the company, including the team she worked on, this team called Civic Integrity, that are working to make this a safer platform, and that there is a better version of Facebook that's possible, but the company just has to, the company doesn't have the incentives right now to create that.
Beyond our borders as well, another topic that came up in the Facebook papers is how Facebook handles content in other countries and in languages beyond English. What problems has Facebook encountered on that front in other countries and in other languages?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of, I think, the most damning things that have come out of these revelations. So, you know, Facebook has expanded globally, right? It's in hundreds of countries, you know, and in many of these countries outside of the US, there are many places where Facebook sort of is in effect the internet. People access the internet primarily on their mobile phones. And, you know, Facebook is like a real main communications channel for them, even more so maybe than the way we think of it here. But the problem is that there in many countries Facebook operates in, it doesn't necessarily have on the ground presence, and it doesn't necessarily have language and cultural expertise. And that includes in its artificial intelligence systems. And that's important because, you know, Facebook is huge. There are, you know, billions of users. You can imagine the volume of content that is being posted every day. In order to enforce its own rules about what's allowed on the platform, you know, there's no way humans could monitor all of that. So Facebook uses artificial intelligence, machine learning, to scan through, to identify, you know, posts that it thinks breaks its rules, whether it's about hate speech or nudity or child exploitation or, you know, suicide and self-harm. But the problem is there are many countries where these artificial intelligence systems just aren't trained in the local language. I mean, one of the examples in the Facebook papers was that, you know, in Afghanistan, like Facebook was only able to take down about 1% of hate speech because it just wasn't able to understand like several of the main languages. This has also been true in India, where it's you know, its rules, its community standards, you know, weren't translated into some of the major languages spoken in India. And so that becomes a real problem because it's, you know, Facebook can then can't see what is happening on the platform. And also, if, you know, users themselves aren't able to read the rules in their own languages, that itself is a problem.
That's a barrier. NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond explaining the controversies, the warnings about the platforms and who is at risk with the content. Do you think Congress should change the rules for what Facebook must abide by to do business? Did you read the leaked internal documents? Did you read the Wall Street Journal's Facebook files? What stood out to you? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Shannon Bond after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The scrutiny that Facebook faces isn't going away soon, but that doesn't mean Wall Street is shying away. We're spending the hour on the social media giant here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The headline in Bloomberg recently, Facebook's profit engine is proving irresistible for investors, citing the company is projected to generate nearly $40 billion in profit this year. Will the whistleblower testimony, the thousands of pages of internal research we've been talking about, will it rattle investors? What are you watching for in litigation by regulators? Join in 800-642-1234. NPR's tech correspondent Shannon Bond covers Facebook and with us for the hour. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is joining us from Racine. Hi, Chris. What is on your mind about Facebook?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, I was on Instagram the other day, and it popped up, a list popped up saying, update your contact list, and it started off with my dad's name, and it included the car that he drives, make, model, and year. And that's not in any information I've ever had on my phone. So that disturbed me. And also, I have worked in mental health with children since 1980, and I have noticed such a tremendous increase in suicide and bullying and cyberbullying and all the mental anguish that has happened with the proliferation of the social media.
Chris, thank you for those comments. Chris, bringing up two different aspects here, Shannon Bond. The first being, you know, updating her contact information and finding some kind of disturbing information.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of these core, you know, issues with Facebook, right? Is this question about privacy, how much data it's collecting and how much data it really needs. And I think, you know, the company has long operated like in a way sort of, you know, we're going to suck up as much data as we can, because you never know what's going to be useful, right? And of course, you know, that is ultimately the business that it's built, is with targeted advertising, where, you know, it allows advertisers to be really specific in how they are able to reach people who they think are going to be, you know, interested in whatever it is they're selling. And so, you know, that kind of data, the kind of information Facebook has on, you know, who we are, what we're interested in, who we're friends with, where we live, where we go, what we buy, is really powerful. And, you know, the idea that they maybe should back off that, you know, is something the company has been very sort of slow to warm up to. I will say they did make a big announcement yesterday, actually about targeted advertising, where they are going to stop letting advertisers use certain, what they're calling sensitive topics to advertise. So they basically can't advertise to people based on, you know, what Facebook thinks may be their interest in topics like, you know, political affiliation, race and ethnicity, religion, health, which, you know, will have a whole bunch of kind of downstream effects. But it is, you know, sort of one of the first step backs we've seen from Facebook when in terms of like how it's thinking about the data it collects and what it allows advertisers to use. So an important step, but probably doesn't go nearly as far as what many privacy advocates would ask for.
You know, something to watch for there. Chris also brought up mental health. And in the Facebook papers, the company's own research found Instagram had been harmful to some teenage girls. Zuckerberg said in a House committee in March that research about social media and its impact on children's mental health wasn't conclusive. What do you see there going on in kids' mental health?
I mean, I think understandably, you know, Zuckerberg has gotten a lot of pushback for that comment, especially when it seems that their own researchers were looking at these issues and were raising concerns. I mean, what is true is that the study that Facebook did looking at teens' mental health, it was a small survey of a small group of teenagers. And so it's hard to draw like population level results from that. Mm. But look, I think every parent, you know, has concerns about these things. And the fact that Facebook itself is studying, you know, these issues suggest that they're salient and they're important, and it's important for them to understand. I think the truth is there is a lot of ambiguity about the long-term impacts of social media on kids, partly because, you know, many of these platforms haven't been around long enough for us to truly understand. But I think you hear so many examples of, you know, issues with bullying, you know, concerns about self-harm and body image. And, you know, these platforms, they do, you know, especially a platform like Instagram that's so visually driven, that does sort of reward you with, you know, your follower count and your likes and, you know, are people following me? Are people engaging with what I'm putting up there? Am I getting sort of validated for that? And I think there are a lot of really legitimate concerns about what that does, you know, what that does to adults, let alone what that does to developing brains of children.
You mentioned some developments on the advertising front on Facebook. Congress is also working on privacy laws, looking at algorithms. And one new one is the Filter Bubble Transparency Act, allowing users to opt out of having personal data-driven algorithms select the content they see. Isn't algorithm-free feed, is that feasible? Is that a viable, you know, way out of this problem with misinformation?
You know, it actually already exists on Facebook. There is an option where you can turn off in your newsfeed, you can switch it to chronological. So It would just be showing you the latest posts. Now the company does, you know, they don't, that's something you have to go into your settings and switch. And it often sort of isn't sticky. Like people will find that they have to go back in and switch it over and over again. You know, the company itself, again, in these Facebook papers, has done some studying on this and found that it actually didn't, like taking away the algorithm ordered feed for a chronological feed didn't actually improve the quality of content people were seeing. So,
wow.
You know, it's not clear that that's really going to kind of get at this issue, but it does get at this broader concern about, you know, this is a bit of a black box. It's hard to understand why it is we're seeing what we see when we log onto Facebook. And, you know, generally speaking, you know, if the algorithm is going to be showing you things it thinks you're going to be interested in, you know, that can worsen sort of, you know, the filter bubble, the sort of echo chambers you're in. And, you know, if in a very reductive way, you know, content that's very engaging is content that's emotionally compelling. And, you know, that can be good. It can be pictures of your new niece, but it can also be really negative, right? Like people were brought together on Facebook, you know, in order to, ahead of the January 6th attack on the US Capitol because of common interests. And so I think it really cuts both ways. And I think it's encouraging to see Congress, you know, want to delve into this question of algorithms, but I'm not sure that simply getting rid of them is going to be the fix that they're hoping for.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Shannon Bond, who's a technology correspondent for NPR, as we talk about Facebook, its future, and how you use social media. Are you on Facebook? How often do you log in? Why do you like it? How do you connect with other people? And what keeps you engaged on these social media apps and the platform? 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Facebook revenue keeps growing and growing and growing. What do you make of how the profits scale up and the increase and where might there be, you know, an end to that? Because of course, investors would be very interested to know as well, I'm sure.
Right, if I had a crystal ball. but no, I think it does sort of suggest this disconnect, right? So Facebook, it's hugely profitable. You know, it makes a ton of sales and ton of profits, and almost all of that is driven by advertising. And so, you know, throughout all of these scandals we've talked about, not just this most recent one, but, you know, previous years, Facebook's advertising revenues just keep going up. Like, advertisers still see value in the platform, you know, and I think some of that can get into, you know, you can get into the broader media market, right? Like, you know, the compare, you know, like they feel that they can get a better return advertising on Facebook, maybe where they used to be advertising on television or in magazines, newspapers. I mean, that's a whole sort of media criticism side of things. Mm-hmm. But I think it also shows you that, you know, like you can have a lot of this public outcry, but at the end of the day, people are going to put their money where they think it's going to work. And we even saw back in the summer of 2020, there was an organized advertising boycott of Facebook where a lot of big brands, you know, said they were temporarily withholding advertising to protest the way the company was handling hate speech. And again, you know, that didn't seem to have any dent on the actual profits and revenues in that quarter. So, you know, I don't know what to make of that disconnect. I guess I don't know what to make of what would break through. You know, what would be something where I think it would have to be something showing the advertisers that, you know, this, it actually wasn't working anymore. That, you know, the growth, that there are real substantial, not just worries about growth, but actual declines in growth. I mean, it's really about whether they feel they can reach the eyeballs they want to reach. And apparently right now they still can do that on Facebook.
Let's hone in here a bit more on misinformation, because Facebook faced heavy criticism for misinformation surrounding the 2016 presidential election and the report that surfaced that found false news reports outperformed real news in feeds. Take us to the present. How has Facebook responded to pressures to crack down on misinformation?
I mean, I think from where they were, the company has changed quite a bit, even though critics will say it's not enough, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, just think about, you know, how crazy the past 2 years have been, right? We're living through a global pandemic. We had the 2020 presidential election. You know, we had the rise of conspiracy theories like QAnon. And, you know, and all of these things really did intersect on social media, and it's forced companies like Facebook, not just Facebook, Twitter too, Google as well, to you know, do something they were very uncomfortable doing for a long time, which is to take a stand and say, there are some things, you know, that are like, we're saying this is true and this is false, and there's some things you can't say. Now, Facebook has done that in a limited way. It's done that when it's come to health misinformation around COVID and vaccines. You know, it did it with, you know, claims about election fraud. It's starting to roll out some new policies around, climate misinformation, you know, claims that the climate change is not real, is not happening, or is not a real threat. But, you know, it has been slow to adjust. And I think, you know, what happens is that's why we see these reports over and over again. Facebook said it was going to stop, you know, these false vaccine claims, but look how easy it is to find them. I mean, those stories happen over and over again because these systems are imperfect. And often, you know, it seems like the company has been slow in rolling them out or been sort of cautious in how to roll them out.
NPR's Shannon Bond stays with us on the future of Facebook, the troubles it has, and now whose parent company is called Meta and what the future holds for the internet. What have you heard about the so-called metaverse? Are you looking forward to a blurring of the lines between real and virtual life? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Shannon Bond here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Facebook is now Meta, and here's CEO Mark Zuckerberg telling us to make the name switch last month as part of Facebook's developer conference.
From now on, we're going to be Metaverse first, not Facebook first. That means that over time, you won't need to use Facebook to use our other services.
What do you think of the name change to Meta? What does it mean? 800-642-1234. NPR Shannon Bond covers Silicon Valley and tech, and she's with us for about 9 more minutes. Okay, so then Meta happened. Shannon, what's going on with the name change?
It's a great question. I think a lot of people, right, raise their eyebrows at the timing of this. Of course, you know, these sort of corporate overhauls do take a long time. But, you know, I also think it's meaningful that Facebook decided to do this now. So the idea here, as we heard Mark Zuckerberg say there, is that, you know, Facebook is looking to sort of its next iteration, right? It is dominated our smartphones, you know, the era of the smartphone internet. And now, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and other folks in Silicon Valley are really excited about this idea called the metaverse. Basically, this is sort of the next place that we're all going to be moving online, spending time, spending money, critically. And so, you know, Facebook, this change from Facebook to Meta, I think Mark Zuckerberg is trying to indicate, you know, our past was in social networking, but moving forward, we are more than just social networking. And so calling ourselves Facebook doesn't make sense anymore. You know, I think it also has the added benefit of maybe distancing themselves to a degree from what has become a pretty toxic brand.
So what is this so-called metaverse? Can you give us more construct with this? Give us a little bit more to what it is.
Yeah, it's one of these really squishy terms. I mean, so this is a term that actually, you know, dates back to 1992 to a science fiction novel. And the idea, the way people talk about it now, is that the metaverse is sort of these immersive virtual spaces where you could play games, you could attend a concert, you could go to your work meetings, right? Instead of in Zoom, you're going to do it in VR. And, you know, you can buy things, you can sort of do all the things that you do in regular real life, but you're doing them in these virtual spaces. And that's enabled mostly by virtual reality. So the idea is, you know, we could pop on these headsets and enter these virtual spaces. Now, some of this does already exist. I mean, frankly, you know, the game Second Life, which listeners may be familiar with, you know, has been around for a couple decades. And, you know, it's a virtual world that you can go and interact in. You know, more recently, you know, it's become very popular in gaming, these ideas, games like Roblox and Fortnite, where you can kind of go in and be in these spaces, you know, build things, kind of create these virtual worlds. But a lot of the technology that Facebook, you know, sort of was talking about and demonstrating as it laid out its vision for, you know, how it was going to be in the metaverse just doesn't exist yet, or, you know, is sort of in the very early stages of development. So I think it's going to be a while before all of us are just like popping on VR headsets all day long, spending all day in these virtual environments. Right now, it's still pretty niche, a pretty niche habit that people have.
So something I really want to ask you is, going back to the papers, how will history judge Frances Haugen and other whistleblowers, the documents shared with the Wall Street Journal, other news organizations? How will the history books see whistleblowing and big tech?
I mean, I think this is a really, like, you know, probably one of the most sort of high profile, you know, maybe a textbook example of this kind of, you know, doing something like this, because Frances Haugen came out, you know, under her real name, with receipts, right? Like, it's not, she wasn't just saying, this is what happened while I was there. She's saying, look, you can read it yourself. You can see yourselves what people inside Facebook are talking about, what concerns they've raised. And I think that sort of, that degree of specificity has made a real difference here. And look, this is not without risk, right? I mean, Silicon Valley, these companies are very powerful. These jobs are very competitive. People sign non-disclosure agreements and non-disparagement agreements. You know, and so there's real threats to people for speaking out. And for many people, even if they're disillusioned, you know, they often leave these companies and don't talk publicly. So I think this will be, you know, this does feel like a change. The question is, does it spur more change? Are we going to hear from more Facebook whistleblowers in the future? And that, I think, could be the real mark of its lasting impact.
Jim from Lake Mills called, couldn't stay with us. Jim deleted their Facebook account, said that they were getting targeted ads and think it's invasive, and wants to know, how likely is it that enough people would just delete their accounts and Facebook would be forced to change?
I mean, the problem is, when you're thinking about, you know, 3 billion people, you got to have a pretty meaningful number of those people delete accounts before it does have a bite. You know, we were talking before, you know, what would make advertisers walk away? Well, if, you know, the user base shrank. But these are such large numbers. I mean, there have been efforts. There have been, you know, movements, hashtag delete Facebook. They never quite seem to gain that much traction. And again, I think this gets back to this question that we hear in Congress and from other critics saying this is really a competition issue. Maybe people would be more willing to leave Facebook if they felt they had other options, other places they could connect with friends and family, or the interests, you know, the groups they're interested in. But right now, I think a lot of people just feel, you know, there's a lot of friction to getting off Facebook.
let's look more into your crystal ball here in our last few minutes and help us draw a connection to legal violations, because securities regulators will, I presume, take these internal documents and this testimony provided by Frances Haugen, the former Facebook product manager, and then they'll need to show clear violations of laws. How will they show that Facebook was reckless with information and broke corporate governance laws?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real question. So Frances Haugen has turned over these documents to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And, you know, ultimately, they are kind of looking out for the welfare of investors. And so the question is, you know, is there demonstrable proof that Facebook sort of said one thing publicly to investors? So said, you know, we're really good at taking down hate speech. And actually, here are, you know, a bunch of documents indicating they're not. Mm. And I don't necessarily think that all of the areas that Frances Haugen has highlighted are things that the SEC is going to sort of gain traction with. I mean, I think some of the maybe the most promising areas may be around some of the claims they've made about growth, about audience growth, and about the way it's their advertising works. But again, that's it's kind of unclear. You know, another avenue may be, you know, there's been reporting that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, may also be interested in looking at some of this around privacy, because, you know, Facebook has already paid penalties. They paid a $5 billion penalty over the Cambridge Analytica privacy issue.
Which was a huge penalty. I mean, that was record-setting. Yes.
Record-setting, right. And sort of, you know, not a lot of money for Facebook, but for any other company, a massive amount of money. And that, you know, that came with, they agreed to, you know, certain monitoring about how they are protecting users' privacy. And so, you know, there's a question is, if there is there stuff in here that the FTC may look at and say, look, you know, you really haven't upheld your side of the bargain here. You haven't done the things you said you would when it came to protecting your users. But, you know, those investigations will take a long time. You know, I think it's pretty early to say whether they're going to get a lot of traction and whether there will ultimately be enough there. I mean, I think that's part of the reason that Frances Haugen went public with this, right? Was that, you know, to draw public attention to what's happening, regardless of, you know, what regulators decide to act on, and to help, you know, I think another one of her goals was to, you know, talk to Congress, talk to lawmakers, and try to help inform them about the, you know, what they might be able to do, whether it's, you know, here in Congress or in the EU, and when it comes to rethinking regulation around big tech.
We only have a few seconds left, but you're based in Silicon Valley, and I'm wondering, is Facebook's image similar to what we're hearing through news reports? Is it really that similar on the ground where you are?
I mean, it's a behemoth, right? There are tons and tons of people out here who work for Facebook, and many of these people, you know, the people are doing good and hard work there, and it's some of the most challenging work of their careers, they will tell you. And a lot of people don't necessarily pay attention to the news cycles, or, you know, kind of buy into the company's line that, you know, this is, you know, a targeted attack on them. But I think increasingly we are hearing more generally from tech employees saying, you know, we want to believe in the companies we're working for. We want to believe they're doing good in the world. Mm. And we want to hold our leadership accountable if it seems like that's not happening. So,
Shannon, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. I enjoyed it.
Shannon Bond is a technology correspondent for NPR covering Silicon Valley and big tech. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.